Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. 3 weeks ago, we began a discussion of the United States Supreme Court's recently completed term. We discussed a few of the decisions, notably homeless sweeps. And we've heard all week those sweeps really began with a new gusto here in the city. And the governor wants similar homeless sweeps carried out throughout the state. We also talked about presidential immunity. There were many more interesting and important matters of which we never spoke. And nor did we talk about how it might affect your life today. Needless to say, there's plenty to talk about this year. In response to the decision of presidential immunity and what at least he perceived as bias and conflict of interest involving at least two or more of the justices, President Biden wrote an op-ed in the New York Times calling for term limits, specified terms such as that justices are appointed on a regular basis, a code of conduct, and conflict of interest legislation. With another year of activism, politics, a few surprises, and some leaks, we find ourselves once again asking the question, what's next? Tonight we have a lot to cover, as once again the list is lengthy, and in many instances, the list again appears purposeful. We will hear from three attorneys extraordinaire, and we'll look at some of these decisions, how they highlight the Supreme Court's latest term, perhaps take a look forward at what's coming next, and about some of the issues surrounding the court, the leaks, efforts to maybe change the structure. There's a lot going on. Passions are running high on some of these issues. We want to hear your take on this. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And please bear in mind that our guests are here to educate and inform about the legal issues of the day. They're not providing legal advice on particular cases, and their opinions are not necessarily the opinions of KALW, NPR, the Bar Association of San Francisco, and most particularly, they may not be the opinions of our guests' employers or clients. They're here to educate. They're here to inform and maybe have some fun along the way. Tonight, we have a panel of outstanding guests to help us make some sense out of what appears just short of chaos. Having tried cases ranging from antitrust to wire fraud and from patent litigation to white-collar crime and murder, James Brosnahan defended John Philip Walker Lind, the so-called Marin Taliban, an American captured by United States forces as an enemy combatant during the invasion of Afghanistan and prosecuted former Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger for the Iran-Contra affair. Jim Brosnahan is a local legend and the author of Justice at Trial, still a must-read. It just hit the bookstands this time last year. Ben Foyer is the chairman of the Complex Appellate Litigation Group, a boutique law firm specializing in high-stakes appeals with offices throughout California. Ben's been called one of the top appellate litigators in California. His writing on appellate and constitutional law issues has been published in the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and the San Francisco Chronicle. Ann Voigt is a partner at King & Spalding. She previously served as a clerk for the Ninth Circuit and the United States Supreme Court, and formerly as a federal prosecutor. Ann has worked on cases before the United States Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court. And without further ado, Ben and Jim, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
We're happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, before we get knee deep into these cases, I want to start with a brief discussion of the op-ed that the president had in the New York Times earlier this week. The president was talking about some ideas like term limits and a more organized way of scheduling when these appointments come up, and even a constitutional amendment to reverse the decision we discussed last week on presidential immunity. Let's start with the idea of term limits. Ben, what are your thoughts about that? I know you wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times that printed, I believe, back in 2017.
Yeah. 2017. President took a few years to get around to reading it, you know.
And, you got to jump on the president. But
stealing my idea. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not my idea. There were a couple of scholars in the aughts who came up, you know, they were looking at what was going on with Supreme Court nominations and how, you know, horrifyingly bitter they had become. That was the focus at the time, and how, you know, they were personal and extremely sort of overwrought events in our society. And you had this, you also, along with it, would have this, you know, kind of morbid death watch of sick, you know, or elderly Supreme Court justices, you know, sort of like, oh, is he going to die? When is he going to die? Or when is he going to retire? And you know, Justice Ginsburg, we saw Justice Kennedy.
You know, you mentioned that in your op-ed about Justice Ginsburg. This is obviously years before she passed.
Yeah.
And how liberals who were concerned about her were sending her recipes with kale.
Oh, yeah. You don't remember that? I'll tell you, you read that op-ed from 2017, you realize just how long ago 2017 was in our political and legal environment. People were sending her kale to try to keep her going, you know, when Donald Trump became president. And, you know, all of it was just so unseemly. But even long before that, it was unseemly. And so these scholars sort of looked at this process and they said, well, how do we turn down the volume on Supreme Court nominations? Why is it so intense? And also kind of random, right? I mean, it's sort of, you know, a Supreme Court justice, you know, passes away suddenly, like Justice Scalia, may pass away after a lingering illness, like, you know, Justice Ginsburg. And you kind of have this randomness to the timing on the appointments of these incredibly important figures in our constitutional structure. Doesn't that seem maybe like a bad idea as you look at it? And if you go back to the founding, you know, the life tenure was very important for protecting, you know, not just Supreme Court justices, but also lower federal court justices from sort of political interference, right? The idea that if you don't rule the way I want, you're going to get fired or you're not going to get another job. But at that time, people certainly did not live as long, not regularly. Right. And they were not appointed as young as they, you know, often, you know, now folks want to appoint them today, because you get folks in, you know, like Brett Kavanaugh or Amy Coney Barrett, or I think they're in their 40s when they came on the court. They could be there for 40 years, potentially, you know, making decisions affecting our lives. They may well outlast all of us on this call or on this radio program. So these professors sort of looked at this and said, well, how, you know, maybe this isn't such a good idea. Is there a better way to do it? And what they came up with is the idea of 18-year Supreme Court terms, right? 18 years is a long time. There's lots of protection for justices to rule the way that they want to or feel like they should. But it's not forever. And if you set up a structure correctly with 18 years terms, you can probably arrange things whereby every 2 years, a new Supreme Court justice is appointed. That would add a little bit of regularity to the process, but it would also make the stakes lower for every single appointment. Because you know what? If you don't get the person you want this time, you're going to get somebody else in 2 years, or they're going to have an opportunity 2 years from now. Essentially allow each president to appoint two Supreme Court justices to 18-year terms. And that would maybe solve a lot of the problems that people have with the Supreme Court. You're not going to get opinions. That doesn't mean you're going to get an opinion that you want or that aligns with one side's political preferences or another side's political preferences. But it means that each appointment becomes in some ways less do or die, less overwhelmingly critical. And maybe that would make our system of government work a little bit better when it comes to the Supreme Court.
Let me pass it to Anne. Do you think this idea of an appointment every 2 years is going to work?
I think it's a good idea. I don't think it goes far enough, and I'm prepared to be shouted down by Jim and Ben on this. But as we talked about, I actually think it would be better if we also added more justices, and if the court would hear cases based on a randomly drawn selection of them. I think that works relatively well in the circuit courts as a way of sort of preventing people from strategic litigation that's geared to a particular set of judges. And it might reduce some of the ways that we are seeing cases litigated now that are very specific to the justices they know are going to be hearing things.
Jim, one of the other things that came up in this op-ed, the one that really caught my ear, was the idea of putting together a constitutional amendment, maybe convening a constitutional convention in order to take away some of the immunities that the Supreme Court just conveyed to the president. Do you think that idea sounds like a good idea?
Well, I'm biased, I have to admit, because I think the case that you're talking about granted to this any president immunity for crimes. It's not a complicated case. And it's applied to a case which was taken before it's tried, before there's a record down below, and a presumption, which is a disgraced idea, was passed. I know I'm getting hyperbolic here, but you asked me the question. It's one of the worst. It's one of the worst cases, among the worst four cases in the history of the court. It violates something that Lord Coke said to Charles I many, many years ago, which has come down and people take it for granted. He told the king, nobody is above the law. That changed with this opinion. So that's my reaction to your question.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Jim is accurately describing the opinion. It did not make the president immune from crimes. It had certain core powers of the presidency cannot be made sort of into crimes, I think is what it held. And then it had some other issues that may well be well criticized. One of the worst four decisions in the court's history, that I think is probably doubtful, but remains to be seen. You never know. The question of whether or not we should have a constitutional convention to reverse that decision, I think is I think that's quite a poor idea. Look, if you're going to have a constitutional convention, there are a lot of decisions that maybe, and a lot of principles of law that maybe, you know, deserve a second look, right? Most recently, you have the Supreme Court's decision that the Constitution doesn't protect abortion. Frankly, forget about the Supreme Court. Maybe we want to go back to the Constitution and wonder whether we should have a right to privacy or sort of bodily medical autonomy in general, if we're going back and really rethinking the Constitution. Maybe we should ask whether the Electoral College is such a great idea. Arguably the Second Amendment is fairly clear that it's only a militia-based amendment, but the Supreme Court has interpreted it differently. You know, if you're going to open up the box of the Constitution in a broad way with a convention, you know, you're going to be really reevaluating a lot of things. You're also going to be reevaluating laws that perhaps left-leaning folks really like, right?
Once you open up that box, once you have a constitutional convention, there's no limits on what they can pick up. So you could open that door with one agenda in mind and you could end up with a decision. Well, who cares what the rights are? If you're arrested, you're guilty. Who needs trial? I mean, it could be anything.
Anything could happen, right? If you're a terrorist, you can, you know, if you're an illegal immigrant, you can be deported. Certainly birthright citizenship would be, you know, a very open question. There are all kinds of principles with a convention. Now you could propose a specific amendment related to presidential immunity, But I don't think that's going to really get anywhere. I mean, the right really likes kind of the idea of an imperial president. They always wanted to be sort of hammered in and controlled by a powerful central figure. That's sort of part of the culture in a certain way, at least parts of the right. So
without the administrative agencies to provide the expertise that would guide the person how to work.
Well, I think it'd be fine with those agencies if they
just the city or pet stuff.
Well, I think they'd be fine with those agencies if those agencies just sort of decided things the way they wanted, right? So I tend to think that a constitutional convention is probably a bad idea. You want to propose any given amendment? Sure. Why not take them one at a time by amendment?
Let me jump to Ramon from San Ramon. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to touch on one thing. I don't know if you already talked about the Supreme Court turning over Roe v. Wade, but the implications, I know the people on the left love to fight and champion for infanticide, but they did not outlaw abortion. All they did was send it down to the states, despite what the Harris campaign is saying. Nobody tried to ban abortion nationwide. Nobody's going to. It's a state's law matter. They need to calm the hysteria, but then the fear-mongering is what gets them votes, so I get it. So I just wanted to make that known and make that clear, despite the rallying cry, we must kill babies at the drive-thru. Have a nice night.
Actually, let me correct you on that. There was a call to create a nationwide ban. It was something that the folks that were making those noises have backed away from because they realize that it would almost guarantee that the very thing they don't want will be, you don't want to have it a rallying cry for the Democrats to the extent it would be even stronger with the threat of a nationwide ban. So that was changed. The talking point changed. But go back in your op-eds, go back and look a year ago, see what they were saying. They were absolutely calling for a nationwide ban. And let me turn it to you, Jim. You're up.
I think Jim has
thank you. I wanted, if it's all right, to go back and to read a very short part of Justice Roberts' opinion in the immunity case. And here's what he said. At least with respect to the president's exercise of his core constitutional powers, this immunity must be absolute. Absolute. As for his remaining official actions, he is also entitled to immunity. Immunity from what is the question? From crimes committed, allegedly, by authorities in office. So I think that's an important takeaway. As to the as to abortion, the court has allowed states to have very restrictive laws, and I appreciate the comment by the gentleman in the audience, but it was a momentous decision in my view. Anyway, thank you.
Well, the court has also allowed national bans on, for example, partial birth abortion. So, those national bans have gone into effect. They're just not quite as early as some of the anti-abortion groups would like yet.
And you've been trying to get a word in for a bit.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say one of the interesting things that the caller mentioning, the Dobbs decision, is both Dobbs and then more recently the Trump decision have been plagued by leaks. Obviously, in Dobbs, you had the opinion that was leaked before it actually came out. And then yesterday, I think it was, we had an article about the Trump immunity decision where they were talking about the fact that Chief Justice Roberts was essentially very set on writing the opinion a particular way and had no interest in trying to get buy-in from any of the liberal justices. And some of his concerns that he's had in the past about the court being perceived as political or whether it would affect the court as an institution seem to have fallen by the wayside. This is one issue on which I think he is very committed, and that is this view of this kind of broad, powerful presidency that is not necessarily subject to check by other forces.
That said, what do we know about these leaks? Are they coming from the same place? Is it a very porous court right now? Where do you think these are coming from?
I have no special information on this, but I do think the leak is coming from inside the house. There's a lot of speculation that it was coming from and from particular people in the house. There's a lot of speculation with the Dubs investigation that it came from clerks.
With you. Yeah.
You know, I don't think it was coming from, I don't think this information is coming from clerks. I think that there are particular justices, or oftentimes the justices have viewpoints that they want to get out. And I think sometimes those come out in these articles.
Yeah, I don't know how the Dobbs opinion leaked. I think that's a real mystery that maybe we'll learn in one day, the way we kind of one day learned who Deep Throat was. But the leaks, that the sort of more minor leaks that you see in the post-term leaks that came out in the last few days, about how certain decisions, came about, those sound awfully like they came from certain justices, who have a relationship with the media and want to convey those points to the media for one reason or another, probably to send a message to other justices on the court or possibly the political actor, bodies. The Dobbs leak, though, that is a real mystery. I think there are a million theories. The court could not figure it out. They involved, sort of federal agencies that just could not figure it out. Whoever did leak it did it very carefully with photographs of printed papers. But the fact that we've had so many leaks, and this never happened, until the last, couple of years, but nothing like this happened.
But there is so much visibility, not just with leaks and information within the court getting out, but the idea of knowing what flags a justice has in front of their house or who they hang around with. I mean, these are things that a generation ago never existed. Is it this intense scrutiny that's creating the leaks rather than a rogue justice or an affected clerk? Jim's been trying to get a word in for a minute.
Well, I just want to add to the comments because an ethics program like the ones that all the other judges have in the United States would stop a lot of what we're worried about in terms of leaks and calling press people, if that happened. I don't have any evidence that a justice did it, but it's certainly possible. I agree with Ben. It's possible. It could have been a clerk, whatever. But the other part of what we're talking about is the effective absence of a code of ethics and the inability to justify why this court is not bound like every other judge in the United States. And other judges wouldn't dream of talking to a press person about a pending case. They wouldn't think of it. There's nothing cute about it. And it's not just lawyers, but people should be shocked about that problem and try to get to the bottom of it as to who did it.
Jim, yeah. I completely agree. And look, as a practical matter, do I think that these justices' views are actually swayed by who they have lunch or dinner with? No. These are generally deeply formed views that they've held for a long time. It's why they got nominated. It's why they got confirmed. But that doesn't change the appearance. And for most of the people, who are reading these reports, it raises really troubling questions. Like, it makes them question whether the Supreme Court is a court for them. Or a court for the people who have access.
Let me turn to Bill. An ethics code
that's enforceable goes a long way to addressing that.
Let me turn to Bill in San Francisco. Welcome to Legal Rights. You're on the air.
Hi, is this me? Bill?
Bill, are you with us or on the air?
Yeah, okay, great. I don't know if you guys listened to the recordings of that person who faked herself. She came off like she was a right-wing Christian lady, but she was really a reporter. She was talking to Alito and Alito's wife, and this all came out. You can find it on the internet of her recordings. And basically, what she got Mrs. Alito to say was basically the plan is that as soon as Trump gets in, he's retiring, Judge Alito. So you have to look at all the stuff, all the crazy decisions in the last year that have favored Trump blatantly in that light. The plan is that, and probably, I don't know about Clarence Thomas, but definitely Alito is going to leave the bench as long as Trump gets in. So you have to look at, you know, they want to make sure a certain faction on that court make sure Trump does get in so Alito can get out. So, like I said, this is not my opinion. You can find the recordings that the lady made, the interview she did with Mrs. Alito, who was quite willing to talk to a person that she didn't know, and probably talk too much. But anyway, that's the way it is.
And Jim, that begs the question. Bill's point is well brought out, but that begs the question. What is going to be more damaging to the future of democracy, whether you have a Trump White House, but perhaps somebody more moderate, because his appointments weren't as bad as some of the ones already there. Would that actually be as bad as having a Justice Alito and some of the others? I mean,
well, it could be bad, and this is surprising to all of you and your audience. I had a conversation with Mrs. Alito one time at great length, and that was at least 10 years ago, and she was trying to get him to retire at that time, and he didn't. So I hope that helps the listener that maybe that's not going to happen. Could a Trump administration appoint someone worse than Alito? Yes. It's entirely possible if they have to swear that he was cheated out of the election last time or any of those things. In fact, your listener has raised a very important question, because this election is about who will appoint justices to the Supreme Court. And I'm not arguing on the radio show which way that should go, but that's a crucial question for the future of this country.
Could we perhaps arrange for Dick Cheney to go on a hunting expedition with Justice Alito? I'm just saying.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, the idea that Justice Alito is ruling differently because he wants to retire and he wants Trump to win, I think that's probably pretty unlikely, right? Justice Alito is an extremely conservative individual. He doesn't really have a judicial philosophy beyond whatever is the most conservative judicial philosophy he can think of. And that is probably just going to favor, you know, or judicial outcome, I should say, you can think of. And that's going to favor a Republican president and not favor a Democrat president. Thomas has maybe more of an organized judicial philosophy, but is still obviously very conservative. I think both of those men would be thrilled to get out of Washington and be replaced by a Republican that especially Donald Trump would appoint. Because I think, you know, there's really very little question in my mind that Trump's approach to judges in a second Trump term would be anything like his approach to judges in the first Trump term. I think in the first Trump term, he essentially deferred to the Federalist Society and institutional conservatives as to who would be good judges. And I think that didn't work out for him, right? He wanted more favorable decisions, especially from some of his Supreme Court, you know, the judges justices he appointed to the Supreme Court. So I think in a second Trump term, he would pick sort of Trumpy MAGA folks to be judges, whether or not the Federalist Society and other conservative organizations think they have conservative judicial philosophies.
You know, Ben, I'm sure you agree. That would be particularly true if the Republicans controlled the Senate.
I think that would be especially.
I was just going to say the Judiciary Committee, which approves all that.
Well, and I suspect if you look at the map, I think there's no matter how the presidential election goes, I think there's probably a fairly good chance the Republicans are going to control the Senate. So, you know, you could expect a radically right wing, a much more right wing set of judges at the lower federal courts and certainly Supreme Court justices to be appointed if Trump wins a second term. And as is likely, I think the Republicans control the Senate.
On that cheerful note, you're listening to Your Legal Rights, KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. We return now to Your Legal Rights with Jeff Hayden here on 91.7 KALW.
And once again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights, KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're talking about the recent Supreme Court decisions, what might be next on the horizon, what's going on with the workings of the court, and how it affects you. Our guests are trial attorneys extraordinaire Jim Brosnahan, Ben Foyer, and Voigt. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, toll free, 866-798-8255.
To be fair, Jeff, I just wanted to point out Jim is the only trial attorney extraordinaire on this panel. Ann and I handle appellate work specifically.
After I've made my mistakes.
Yeah.
And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You want to talk about how these decisions affect you? You want to talk about the homeless sweeps that are starting in San Francisco? Whatever it is. You're not limited to the exact point we are in our conversation, but do try to keep it on topic. We're talking about the Supreme Court, some of the things they're doing to change the world or change the election or whatever else you may feel. Let's talk a little bit about redistricting. You know, we took it for granted that redistricting couldn't be done based on race. It seems that everyone agrees, but they disagree on just what it looks like or what it takes to prove it. Jim, I wanted to point this in your direction. It seems that every city or county is all now dividing itself into districts to try to keep things level. Is this case, and we're talking about Alexander v. South Carolina, is this a green light now for mischief?
I think it is. And the case simply stated is it came to the district court, held long hearings, had witnesses, and concluded that the Republican in South Carolina, the Republican-dominated legislature, had redistricted by using racial data to deny the proper number of districts, helping in that case the Republican Party, although the Democrats do it also. They do the same thing. And race was found by the judge to be a factor, that an impermissible factor. It's one thing to have Harvard College have a neutral approach. It's another thing to attack people of color, so they get less representation. That's the case. Now, in terms of the Supreme Court in Alexander, they reversed it, they did have a record in front of them, but they went ahead and reversed it. It's about the fifth redistricting case in recent years, including one in Louisiana, which held that it was a political issue. They wouldn't even get into it. So the takeaway point for that case is that they approved of a situation in which at least the district court, having heard all the evidence, the demeanor, the documents, all of it, we talked about trial in district courts. I have a great respect for district courts, and they reversed that. And I think that's unfortunate for the reputation of the court, actually. We've talked about reputation and problems. I'm a little bit biased on this issue, probably, but that's the case.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, you know, the you know, when the court does something that is not, I don't know if the way the word is honest, but where when the court sort of reaches a decision that, you know, gets to an outcome, but really is sort of transparently not deciding the issue even-handedly, I think that always diminishes the court's reputation, because that underscores the idea that some people have, they're not incorrect, obviously, that the court is, you know, these are really political actors in robes who are finding ways to get to where they want to get to, no matter what. And I think that that is the case for some of them on both the left and the right. But I still think that for most of them, they do have judicial philosophies and they do have judicial approaches that will lead them to whatever outcome their analysis leads them to, even if it's not their political preference. And I think you could see that this term in the fact that many of the a tremendous number of the decisions did not involve a kind of sort of right-left split. Some of the biggest ones did, obviously, Trump against the United States and, you know, other cases. But many, many cases this term in, you know, had you'd have a conservative justice joining with the liberals to create a majority, or two conservative justices joining the liberals to create a majority, or a liberal justice joining with the conservative justices to create a majority. And
OK, but let's circle back about this redistricting case. The real question is, who was aiming for what? And in talking before we went on the air, Jim, I think it was you that was sharing with me an unusual view of one of the justices and what he thinks about how much we need to be protecting things such as the right to vote as to vote, as to race, or maybe affirmative action.
Well, first of all, I want my vote to count equally with everybody else. Redistricting as practiced in some states with Republicans and Democrats, it doesn't do that. It cuts into it. I did want to mention to you also, because I know Ben knows this, in California, we solved this problem. There was, and the voters voted to create a commission of 14 people representative of all walks of life in California. They have now successfully every 10 years, twice, without anybody complaining this time, put together fair constitutional districts in the House, in the Senate, and in the California legislature. That's what ought to be done. People are looking for solutions to some of these things.
That's, of course, there's no what,
yeah.
I mean, there's no gerrymandering in the Senate, right? I mean, the Senate is statewide, so that's not a that's not the issue.
The House, and all of the state districts were the subject of this commission. Thanks.
Yeah. You know, and the commission is great. I mean, it's a great example, I think, of how Democrats, you know, tend to kind of push these good government measures. And Democrats isn't really fair, because this idea was originally pushed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who technically is a Republican, although today the Republican Party would have nothing to do with him, right? Democrats are very good at pushing these good government measures in some of these ways, especially when it comes to districting. And Republicans don't do that in the states Republicans control. They're very happy to gerrymander away. And as a result, in the House, you have fewer Democrat seats than you might if Democrats also gerrymandered as much in the states that have commissions like this. And on one hand, you say, wow, it's very important to have good government. On the other hand, when you voluntarily give up power in a system where power is what matters, there can be some pretty significant negative consequences.
You know, some of the more interesting, and you looked like you were ready to say something.
I was. I was going to say, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the split in this particular case is the divide over who you're supposed to defer to, right? You have the majority decision by Alito saying that there's a presumption that legislatures are acting in good faith, in part because you want to defer to legislatures. This is sort of a core function of theirs. And by contrast, you have the dissent, where Justice Kagan is really focused on lower courts. I think looking at the lower court, you should be deferring to their factual findings. They're the ones who really grappled with this. So in part, this is a fight over who should be deciding what. And to Jim's point, you know, it's interesting to think about whether there are ways to sort of break that, you know, that dispute up.
So let's move on a bit. Some of the more interesting cases involve how a particular amendment applies or how it might apply vis-a-vis another amendment. There's an interesting article we were talking about that looked at how the First Amendment and the internet might pair up. We spoke of one such case last week. There was a few of them. And it talked also in terms of the coalition building between the justices and how that might have changed. Anne, do you want to jump in on that?
I mean, the coalition among, you know, of the justices, you know, it's very interesting how the coalitions of the justices, you know, break down. You know, as I was mentioning, you know, you really do have different groups of justices sort of joining together, not necessarily, you know, aligned with, you know, purely with their party. And the case that you're talking about is, I think, a great example. United States against Ramihi. Am I saying that right, Anne?
I actually brought up the First Amendment and the internet. There were a couple of cases there. Ramihi is an interesting one, which talks about how the Second Amendment stands up. And Ramini talked about a domestic violence restraining order. Volo talked about the First Amendment.
Yeah, I think the issue works better with Ramini. I think the question kind of about coalition building works a little bit better with Ramini, or at least that's the one that I, you know, want to talk about. I mean, that was a case where, you know, the Supreme Court has said that limitations on, you know, laws that limit gun rights have to be tied to sort of traditional laws that limit guns rights. And one of the most conservative circuits said, well, that means that laws that prohibit domestic violence, individuals who are involved in domestic violence from owning guns, those laws are impermissible because there isn't any history in the United States dating back to the founding of taking away guns from people who committed domestic violence. Indeed, back then you could beat your wife and that was fine. There's some real nuts that Trump appointed the first time around. Let's you know, be realistic about it. It would be worse the second time, I promise. But the Supreme Court said no, that's, you know, ludicrous. And that, you know, the idea that somebody who does something violent could lose their right to have a firearm is within the nation's history. And that's really all you need to look at, is this sort of generally something that, you know, the history allows states to regulate. And, you know, the breakdown of Ramini was 8-1, right? So you had, this is a case that is, limiting gun rights, reducing the extremely expansive gun rights that, many conservatives are, I guess, happy to have, for some reason, because you get more of these mass shootings in conservative states than Democrat states, but, you know, okay. But you still had a coalition of 8 justices coming together and saying, no, you know, if you are, especially since the number one cause of death of women who, are suffering from domestic violence is a partner with a gun. And they said, no, there's a way that we have to bring this back in. You did have one justice who said, you know, I think it was Clarence Thomas, who said, yeah, sure, go for it. Let these guys keep their guns. You know, if they kill their wives or girlfriends, too bad. You know, we love guns. But you know, that's a great example where you have a case that, you know, seems to be about a conservative principle. And yet you get a coalition of 8 justices saying, no, this isn't correct. So, you know, the court's coalitions are not just, you know, oh, is this a liberal outcome? Therefore, the liberals are for it. Is it a conservative outcome? No, the conservatives are for it. It's much more complex and nuanced than that.
I would add, if I may, that in the case itself, this was the first case of any regulation by this court of guns. So in that way, it's significant, but it's very narrow. And I think the progressives had to give up quite a bit. But it's also another thing. Roberts and Kavanaugh, in an earlier gun case, made the statement that this didn't mean that we're not going to have some regulation. But here, when you get down to the details, and I won't take your time, it's limited to a really threatening person who has been found to be threatening by a court. And in that case, then you can regulate guns.
You know,
two notes, if I can. One, I think, then maybe a fairer way of characterizing Justice Thomas's dissent would be to say, you know, he said, one, that this is a protective order, so it's not, you know, it is a lighter burden of proof. And two, he said, you do have other ways, like you can charge somebody with aggravated assault. There are other ways of sort of punishing this conduct. I do think an interesting question will be how, if it makes its way to the Supreme Court, the Ninth Circuit decision in Duarte, which was recently taken en banc. So the Ninth Circuit issued a decision saying that it was unconstitutional under the Second Amendment to bar people who are nonviolent felons from subsequently owning guns, and that they couldn't be convicted for that. The Ninth Circuit is reconsidering that now. I think it might well end up in front of the Supreme Court. It'll be interesting to see how they deal with that, because there they specifically said, if it's someone whose prior felonies are for nonviolent conduct, you know, that falls under the Second Amendment's protections.
But that makes sense, right? I mean, I think that it's very likely that the Supreme Court or the Ninth Circuit en banc will either come out the same way, or the Supreme Court will come out that way. Because, look, if you do have a right to have a gun and under the Second Amendment, I'm not very skeptical of the constitutional analysis that led to that individual right, but we seem to have that right now, then there really isn't a very good rational basis to take guns away from someone because you were involved to take a crime, a felony, a famous felon. You were involved in some financial shenanigans when covering up the fact that you gave money to your mistress using election funds, right? You know, nothing about that has anything to do with violence. And it is very hard to see why somebody who engages in that kind of behavior, while clearly a criminal, should lose their right to their constitutional right to possess a gun. An interesting corollary of that, of course, is why should somebody who isn't convicted of a crime involving voting lose their right to vote, their constitutional right to vote, simply because they're convicted of a felony? The Fifth Circuit, by far the most conservative circuit in the country, and radically conservative, more conservative than the Supreme Court right now by a fair measure. The Fifth Circuit said, nah, it's fine. You know, we don't want those felons who happen to many black people who are felons and minorities. We don't want them to be able to vote anyway. So that's fine. But it doesn't make sense. I mean, and the Supreme Court said in the Rahimi case that just because you're not a responsible person is not a valid basis to take away your right to have a gun. By the same token, just because you're not a responsible person isn't a constitutional basis for taking away the right to vote.
And we should hope that a non-responsible person at least is responsible with their guns. Let's move on a bit. One thing we didn't talk much about before, we talked about Snyder versus the United States, which talked about whether a gratuity after the fact is really meant to be a bribe or not. And we had a little talk about that, but it begs a broader question. How is the current Supreme Court, how do they seem to be treating criminal cases in general?
Well, I'll start. Maybe Ann will jump in here too. This is written by Justice Kavanaugh, 6, and 3 dissenters, Jackson, Sotomayor, and Kagan. And in this case, I don't know what they're thinking of. That, I don't say that very often because I agree with Ben that they're working and they're trying to do the right thing. But the bottom line of the case of Snyder versus the United States is that if someone gives in office, gives a concern, a company, $1 million in contracts, and then that company gives $13,000 to the person who gave them the contracts. Are you ready, audience out there? That's not a crime in America. And that's beyond that, I'm not sure anybody can analyze it or justify it. It's crazy.
The only saving grace to that opinion, which makes, I agree with you, Jim, makes absolutely no sense and will be terribly destructive, especially in small towns, where it will be very easy for like the incumbent garbage company to say, look, our policy is to give a gratuity of $50,000 to any city councilman who votes for us to get the garbage contract. Not a bribe, just a gratuity. Makes no sense whatsoever. But the one saving grace is that's a statutory decision, right? They are interpreting a congressional statute. Then Congress, in theory, could revise that statute to very clearly also ban gratuities, as part of this bribery. So there's
it's not only developing and agreeing on the view of a statute, but also there's a lot of tradition in the federal system. You work regulating for a few years, and when you're ready to move on, you get hired to the board of the place that you regulated and get paid very, very well for those friendly relations. Yep. Let me move on for a minute. We're down to the last couple minutes, and I wanted to move on from some of these cases and talk about some of the cases that we might be seeing coming in the next year or two. What strikes you as interesting that's on the docket coming up?
I think there are three cases that, at least to me, are interesting coming up on the next term. There's a Free Speech Coalition case coming out of the Fifth Circuit, which is yet another sort of social media case. And that case about sites that provide what we might colloquially call adult material and whether and what standard of review applies to First Amendment challenges to them. I think it's the continuing sort of struggle of the court to figure out what rules apply to the internet. Second one is the Scrimeti case, which deals with a ban on providing medical care to transgender minors that is gender-affirming care. And then the third is Glossop, which is a case in which the state has actually declined to defend the conviction because of Brady violations. And it'll be interesting to see what the court does with that.
Yeah.
Brady violations are a fact of life, unfortunately. But whether there are actually consequences for them is a whole other story.
Brady, of course, is where a prosecutor withholds evidence. The election cases that we don't yet know what they will be, but there will probably be some, I think are probably going to be a major part, unfortunately, of next term's docket on an emergency basis.
Unless there's a really widespread, in which case maybe not.
Yeah, it's not looking that way. But there is a whole strategy in place, especially in the, on the Trump team, to bring all sorts of legal challenges to any, at least what they had thought of as any Biden victory, now, potentially a Harris victory. But they are that's their thing, right? Is how it's fair if I won, unfair if I lost. But they're readying, legal challenges, based on that.
Ben, I don't want to cut you off, but we're essentially out of time. And I wanted to give each of you about a minute for any closing thoughts. If you want to pick it up where you left off, you got a minute.
Sure. Well, it's going to be a year, election years these days, they're not slow. And as we've seen so far, it's not slow. And unfortunately, I think the court would be happy to stay out of these things. But it's going to be very hard for them to do that. So, buckle your seatbelts, not just for the election, but for the legal follow-on that's, I think, likely to occur.
Jim, do
you want to take about a minute?
Jim, do you want to go?
Two people to watch on the court. Barrett, who has a mind of her own, and that mind is somewhat literal at times. It's not a critique, but she's what's written in the code is kind of a judge. And so that's interesting. But the other one is Jackson, who ruled against defendants in three criminal cases this term, and that may come from her experience on the district court. I think I'm right that she's the only one that was ever on the district court, and she just may have, and if there's another one, that's
Sotomayor, you're right.
So she's going to be very interesting to watch in the criminal area, which continues to be a very important area, for especially for criminal defense lawyers.
And you've got a minute. Take us home.
Okay, I will be very quick. I agree with Jim. I think it's going to be interesting to see how some of the justices continue to, their thinking continues to evolve, and we continue to learn more about it over time. I will just add one caveat, which I think we admitted at the very beginning, which is that all of our views here are our own. We aren't even necessarily speaking for the others on the panel, and they don't represent the views of our clients, our employers, or even sometimes ourselves.
And I'll join you in that. And sometimes we make a crack or a remark. We talk about waiting for someone to leave. Or I even said the most off the wall of all, which was about bringing back Vice President Cheney to go on a hunting expedition. In these days, I should probably have been more mindful. Nobody's advocating anything, and we're not wishing an end to careers of people who have dedicated their lives to public service. But to say we disagree with some a lot of the time is a tremendous understatement. And go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say also, you know, I think I have some sympathy to the stories about what spouses have said. I think most of us with partners would not want to be held responsible for everything that our spouse may or may not have said at a party. But I do think it will be interesting over the next year to see how, you know, in particular, for me, how some of these First Amendment challenges continue to develop and continue to be thought through on the Supreme Court, and how we'll be interesting to see also if the court actually starts taking more cases. I think one of the reasons we have so much focus on political cases is that the number of cases they take has been reduced significantly. And so there's less of the sort of day-to-day disputes that still need to be resolved and where you still need a uniform answer. And that I think reduces the perception of the court as a politicized institution. If you are also dealing with questions about where do you bring a case? You know, what does this particular statute that doesn't really have a political valence mean?
So. And one development I would like to see, but I don't see coming anytime soon, is tone down some of the heat, some of the rhetoric. The amount of scrutiny that's paid to some of these justices, their personal lives, things that really don't affect their decisions, we're drawing that into their work on the court by watching so closely. Let people breathe when they leave. They have a job to do like we all have ours. But that's my own opinion. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Our guests tonight have been appellate attorneys extraordinaire Ben Foyer and Ann Voigt, and Jim Brosnahan, a local attorney this far short of a local legend. Nah, you've made it. You are a local legend. And the author of Justice at Trial.
What was that? I didn't hear you. What was it?
You are a local legend.
Yes, thank
and
you.
The author of Justice at Trial, a must read that hit the bookstores last year. Please join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6, when we begin a frank discussion about the wave of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. In 2 weeks, we're here to talk landlord-tenant law. As always, we're here to take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to our guests for joining us. It's been most enlightening. And all of you for listening in. And at the controls, not one but two, we have Joanne Marr and Elaine Leung. Thank you both. I'm Jeff Hayden. Have a good night and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.